Hello and welcome back to Railway Mania. Our guest today is author David Grimshaw, and we're going to be talking about articulated locomotives, but not the sort that immediately come to mind. These machines were built when Robert Francis Fairley was but a little baby. David, welcome to the show.
Hello. Glad to be here.
So if you can tell us about your background and how you came to write about early North American railroads.
So I'm not a railroad historian. I have written at times about automotive history. I particularly like looking for early automotive technology from what we call the brass era, when they're kind of figuring out how to make cars work, and there are a lot of different ideas about the proper way to do things. But I was visiting my mom's house, and I saw that she had my collection of books from when I was a child. I was very into trains, not into cars. And I was looking through them, and I took some home with me, and I started to wonder if there was any new research, any new information that had come out about, you know, the very early railroads in the United States. And when I went online and started looking things up, I saw that in England, there had been a lot of new research, and there's a lot of new information that just wasn't around, 20, 25 years ago. But when I looked into the situation here in the United States, there was almost nothing new. Everything I could find was still the same stuff I remembered reading when I was a kid. And I thought, with so many collections now digitizing their materials, surely it must be much easier to look into, these early letters and these early company reports and to dig up new information that people just haven't bothered looking for before because they couldn't find it.
Why do you think people ended up just relying on the sort of secondary information rather than going back to primary sources?
I think there's not been a whole lot of interest in the very earliest days of railroading, because even back when people started getting interested in the history of early railroads back in like the 1870s, there was mostly just reliance on people's reminiscences. A lot of these early engineers were still around at that time, and it was just taken that whatever they said, whatever they remembered happening, that's how it actually happened. And that got into the books, and then that information just kept getting repeated. And what I found, particularly as regards these locomotives, most of the information that we have had up till now was stuff that was written down in the 1890s. And it's just been repeated again and again and again. And no one has really gone and looked at the actual source material to figure out what's going on with it.
It's a bit like classical sources when you have stories of, like, the fall of the Roman Republic, and it was written 200 years later. Mm-hmm. And that was just, based on folk tales from that time.
So it made a very interesting research project, because I kept coming across information in the original sources that was similar, but not quite the same as the stuff that had been written down and repeated, for a century after. And so it did cause me some confusion, because I'd be like, oh, well, that's what it says here. And that sounds like what he's saying here, in the 1870s or the 1890s, but it's not quite the same story. It's a little bit different. Then I had to kind of figure out, well, why is it different? And where are they diverging from what actually happened here? And then there's also, we'll touch on this a little bit later, but there were some vested interests at play in not telling the story quite correctly.
Okay. And then what gave you the idea for putting this into a book?
I've published a few different things before, self-publishing just as a hobby. I believe in print media, and I figured if I was going to collect all this information in one place, then I wanted to print it and have it as a volume for easy reference for people. The book itself is kind of like a scrapbook style history, where it has extensive block quotes from the original sources in it. Because I can't be completely assured of everyone's correctness that I quote in the book, I have endnotes. There's several pages of endnotes for every chapter. So if there is something wrong, they can find out who was wrong. It wasn't me. I was just repeating what they said.
Yeah, absolutely. If to get into the story then, in your own words, if we can introduce the central characters.
Yes. So I think to properly understand the story of these articulated locomotives, we kind of have to look at several of the people that were involved, and then the technology as they understood it at the time. So our main character here is going to be Horatio Allen, who graduated from Columbia University in 1823. And he was a resident engineer on the I believe the Chesapeake and Delaware in the 1820s, and then he moved on to the Delaware and Hudson Canal Company, where he worked under John B. Jervis, who is another character we'll get back to. About 1828, he took a trip to England to study railways. And here he met people like George Stephenson, and he visited the Stockton and Darlington, and he had...
Because this is before the Liverpool-Manchester would have opened.
Yes. So he takes a visit in 1828, and then also, famously, he was acting as an agent for Delaware and Hudson to purchase locomotives for them. Which, of course, brings us to the Storbridge Lion, which was one of the locomotives that he ordered and he brought back to the United States.
So he was there right at the start.
Yes. So he was involved in the very first full-size steam locomotive that ever ran in the United States. Just interestingly, one of our other main characters here is a person named Ezra L. Miller, who was visiting England in 1828 for the same reasons, but on behalf of the South Carolina Canal and Railroad Company.
Right.
And he visited many of the same locations. I don't know if Miller and Allen met in England, but I do know that Miller was absolutely convinced of the future of the steam locomotive. And when he came back to the United States, he was instrumental in getting Allen the job as chief engineer on the South Carolina Railroad.
What's the main purpose of the South Carolina Railroad? What was their aim?
South Carolina Railroad, the company was... started in December of 1827. The whole idea, as crazy as this sounds, was that they were going to build a railroad from Charleston inland to Hamburg, South Carolina, which was just across the Savannah River from Augusta, Georgia. And the idea was that if people could send their freight, if they could send their cotton on the railroad instead of down the river, the cotton would end up in Charleston, and Charleston would be, you know, the big port city instead of Savannah, which was at the end of the Savannah River. So they built a railroad to compete with a river, to compete with rafts and steamboats. It was an interesting idea, and I think it kind of displays, you know, the naivety about railroads at the time.
Well, and the hubris, I guess, as well, because...
Yes.
I mean, barges can carry such a huge amount of material, and the locomotives of the time were not really up to the same kind of job, but... You know, if they succeed, then they're seen as visionaries afterwards. It's the new emerging technology that gets everybody excited.
Yeah, and you can see that they were covering their bases somewhat because they include canal in the company name. which, of course, in the 1820s, there was, you know, a lot of debate over what was going to be better, canal systems or railway systems. Mm-hmm. And they put that in there just in case, you know, they could also build a canal if they wanted and not suffer any consequences. But they had the plan to build the railroad from Charleston to Hamburg, which was, at the time, you know, it was a distance of over 130 miles, which was something that had never been done before. And when you think about it, none of these people, except for, you know, Miller, who had gone to England, had ever seen a railway before, had ever seen a locomotive. They didn't have any idea how this was going to be done, but they knew that they had a solution, mm-hmm. and that was what they were going
to
go for.
Well, you've got to set high targets, I guess.
Yeah, so it's a pretty interesting concept, and unfortunately, it didn't work out as well as they had hoped. Back to the story here, we have Miller and we have Allen, and Miller gets Allen to come to South Carolina, and they hire him on as chief engineer of the line. And he's got a little bit of experience with railways and railroads and building them. With the Delaware and Hudson, he has some experience with locomotives and building cars and all that. Then we get to the construction of the line. One of the interesting constraints that Allen had to work with was that the company had already ordered iron bar to use as rail before he was hired.
Okay.
So one of the constraints he had to work with was he had to work with the material they had already ordered. And what they had ordered for him was iron bar that was 2.5 inches wide by 1/2 inch thick. And that was to serve as the surface of the rail. So he had an incredible limit on how much weight he could place on the rail.
Because there were a lot of conversations at the time and a lot of developments in rail technology going around. And obviously locomotives accelerated that because they put so much downward force on the track and were breaking track left, right and centre. So that is, I mean, it doesn't strike me as a terribly thick material to be putting a locomotive on.
No, it isn't. To basically provide the strength was the wooden rail, which he had a rails made of pine, and these were 6 inches thick by 10 inches tall, or 10 inches deep, however you want to put it. And so the wood was basically there to carry the weight, And the iron was basically just serving as a hard surface that prevent the wheels from wearing down on the wood.
Right.
And this was not an entirely uncommon way of doing things back in the 1820s. And Allen had previous experience with the Delaware and Hudson and had, you know, not a particularly great experience in that regard, because when he brought the Sturbridge Line back to the United States, they put it on the track and they found it was far too heavy for the construction used. And so the Sturbridge Line famously never actually went into actual service. They did some test runs and it got parked in the shed, and it slowly got cannibalized for wrought iron and, you know, steam cylinders and parts they could take off of it.
And I don't think they were the only ones in that regard. I think that was a, you know, a very exciting purchase by many people who then found that they'd possibly bitten off more than they could chew.
Yes, it was. There's some disagreement as to how the engine ended up so overweight between Horatio Allen and John B. Jervis. Jervis did not take any pride in being associated with the first steam locomotive of the United States. Reading his memoirs, he seemed very embarrassed about the whole situation, and he notes that one of the things that bothered him most was that his agent, Horatio Allen, who he does not name in the story, did not respect his guidelines for the weight of the locomotive and did not seem to be bothered by the waste of money that was incurred by its failure.
So we're off to a good start then.
Yes. And Horatio Allen attributes it to the English builders who were not sufficiently experienced in the art of building locomotives to keep good watch on keeping the weight of the locomotive down. And so it was just an accident, mm-hmm. and there's not really anyone to blame. Mm. But anyway, this kind of sets the stage for Horatio Allen's concerns about weight and preserving the right-of-way. At the time, there wasn't really, you know, in the 1820s, there was still a lot of question of how do you actually build track. When Allen and Miller visited England, there was still, of course, cast iron track. Mm-hmm. And I know that Miller actually visited the rack railway for the Blenkinsop locomotives.
Yes.
So he saw the cast iron track and the rack rail, and he visited other rails. He saw Stockton and Darlington, where they were using the wrought iron rail. Mm-hmm. Various other railways and plans, you know, they had lines that were built on stone blocks for support. They had lines that were built on wooden sleepers. They had, of course, lines like the South Carolina line, which would be a wooden rail with an iron capping on top.
Do you think that was mainly driven by locally available resources?
Yes, particularly as regards the United States, wrought iron was very expensive. Mm-hmm. And there were also no mills in the United States that could roll rails. So on the consideration of cost, if they were going to import all this rail, and if they were going to pay the import tariff on all this rail,
for 100 odd miles of railway line, yeah.
Yes, then they had better, you know, use as little of the iron as possible to get as far as they could with it. Mm-hmm. So Horatio Allen came on the company and he gives them several different plans of track. And they built a couple of miles of experimental track where they're experimenting with different techniques of construction. But basically they ended up settling on the wooden rail with the iron capping, and it was supported on longitudinal sections. You might call them ties or sleepers, but they're not quite the same thing with the rail wedged into the tops of these longitudinal sections. All of this was actually supported off of the ground on wooden pilings.
So it's not sat on a ballast bed. It's...
No.
It's on a framework.
Yes. Most of the line sat about 3 to 6 feet off the ground. And the idea here was that they would save money because they didn't have to do the earthworks.
It's almost the world's first elevated railway then.
Yes. So what he saw as the advantage here was that they could maintain the grade of the line easier if they didn't have to raise the ground or make cuttings or, you know, etc. So over minor variations in terrain, they could just drive the piles to the proper height, put the track on top of the piles, and then it was basically a done deal.
It makes sense.
So they saved a ton of money and not having to do all the fills and cuts, which for about the first 2/3 of the line, they only had relatively flat land to go over. So mm-hmm. this saved them a lot of money up until they got into the hillier areas further inland. And as a note here, Horatio Allen introduced the 5-foot gauge to the United States. It's interesting because we do have his thoughts written down in engineers' reports from 1829. The whole reason that he's settled on 5 feet between the rails was because this was the size he determined would be best for carrying about 12 to 15 bales of cotton.
Oh, okay.
That was going to be the main freight that they're going to be carrying down from Augusta to Charleston, and he had a size of wagon in his mind that was going to carry 2 tons of freight, and he worked out from the size of the bales of cotton that he wanted the track to be 5 feet wide. And an interesting note here is that the original cars in the railway were built without springs, and they were built with the car body between the wheels. So he was restricted in that sense by the gauge, because he had to fit the car body between the wheels of the car.
Right, right, yes.
And so it's just for that reason that the southern states, the United States, were all built mostly to a 5 foot gauge.
So that decision then,
yes.
Well, famously, so the locomotives in the great locomotive chase of the Civil War were 5 foot gauge, and that's the same continuation all the way through.
Yes.
Wow.
So he chooses the 5 foot gauge. He comes up with a plan of construction for the railway, and then early in 1830. We have Ezra Miller, who's no longer on the board of the company, but he offers to make a contract with them to deliver a locomotive. And that first locomotive, of course, is the Best Friend of Charleston. There's a misconception that Horatio Allen designed the Best Friend of Charleston, which makes sense because he was the chief engineer of the line, but he actually had nothing to do with it. Miller was very set on being the first person to build a steam locomotive in the United States. He had been the one, you know, from the beginning that said steam locomotives are the future. We're going to build the line to be operated by steam locomotives. Mm-hmm. So he has a contract for the locomotive. They bring Best Friend down. Surprisingly, it's a complete success. They had some issues with the wheels not being strong enough, so they built new wheels for it. And then it goes into operation in December of 1830. And we have a letter from Horatio Allen at that time, a letter to Jervis, where he says that between the two of them, he doesn't altogether like her. he has two complaints.
Okay.
The first complaint he has is about the weight. The locomotive only weighs about 4 tons, but more than half of that weight is on one pair of wheels. So it has an unequal weight distribution, and there's too much weight on one axle, according to Allen. Mm-hmm. And if you look up, you know, the drawings of Best Friend, you see it's a vertical boiler locomotive, and the boiler is off to one extreme end of the locomotive rather than in the middle where you would expect it.
Yes.
Yes. So, of course, you would, it's easy to see that one side would be much heavier than the other. And his other complaint was just in the design of the boiler. He didn't like the vertical boiler, or particularly Miller's design for the boiler, which was also very unusual.
And of course, this had nothing to do with, you know, the fact that he didn't design it and he was the chief engineer. Nothing at all to do with ego. No, of course not.
Well, it's very interesting because in some of the writing, we see there's a bit of a quid pro quo going on. Mm-hmm. Miller got Horatio Allen the job. So while Horatio Allen has these reservations, he's not going to talk about them publicly. So there is kind of an interesting interplay between these two characters. But you can already see that we have the groundwork for his idea of we need to distribute the weight evenly already pops up right away as soon as the first locomotive is delivered.
So what was his solution?
We have a engineer's report from Allen from May 16th, 1831. It's very interesting, but it's also very vague. So we have to infer some from what he's writing here. But he does give the basic idea for making a locomotive on 8 wheels. He says he wants to limit the weight to 1.5 tons per pair of wheels, ideally. And at the same time, well, he makes the point that this would necessarily require the locomotive to have more points of contact, that is to say, more wheels on the rails. He also says there's some issues with this. He writes, if 3 or 4 wheels were united on a side to the same rigid straight line, and the road had irregularities in its surface, there would arise great and injurious strains to the structure. And then he continues on, this difficulty may be completely obviated by giving the weight to be supported but 2 points of support on each side and making these points the centers of motion on the pairs of wheels. So we've already got, you know, the rationale behind putting the locomotive on 2 trucks.
Well, he's essentially described power bogies, hasn't he?
Yes. Well, he's subscribed putting the locomotive on 2 points that are on trucks. But then he continues on, as to the change of direction horizontally, as in the entrance of turnouts and the passage of curves, a very simple adjustment will relieve the arrangement from all difficulty. If we connect the frame with a crosspiece only at the center and by a horizontal point, The two sets of wheels will thereby be enabled to pass all curvatures with the facility of two simple wagons connected in the ordinary manner.
Ah, okay. So he's looking at the principle of just, well, the way that wagons move in relation to one another when they're coupled together, so like four-wheeled wagons,
mm-hmm.
and that's giving him the idea for the articulated locomotive.
Now, there is some question here as regards his inspiration for this. Much later, we'll get into Jervis's take on this, because there was a claim by different engineers, depending on who you want to believe, of priority of who was responsible for putting, you know, a truck under a locomotive or a bogey under a locomotive. Jervis believed that even though Allen had built his locomotive first, it was Jervis that deserved credit for doing it. But he also points out that he was not the first person to put a bogey under a locomotive, because there's, of course, Chapman's patent from 1812, where he describes a locomotive sat with a bogey under one end. And we can get back to that when we get into the patent debate that comes up much later.
Yeah.
It's also interesting to note in this engineer's report, we have Horatio Allen say, "The first 100 miles in railroads ever traveled in continuation by steam will take place in South Carolina, the proud day of which performance is not far distant."
Okay. I mean, it's amazing that they were aiming that high that early. I just find that incredible.
Yeah, it's very interesting considering that, you know, Allen only had a very limited amount of practical experience with railroads, and no one else in the company other than Miller had really even seen a railroad in operation, and they were just going out and doing it. They didn't quite understand what they were doing, but they were going to make it work.
Yeah. What are the next steps then? Presumably Horatio Allen sells this idea into the company and they're on board with it?
Yes. He proposes to, you know, make a plan for a locomotive and have it built and shipped back to Charleston. And in 1831, he makes a visit to New York, and he goes to the West Point Foundry, which had already built the Best Friend for them and had built another locomotive called the West Point for them. These are both engines on four wheels. He sent them plans for an eight-wheeled double-ended locomotive. And it's kind of interesting here because there's some evidence that the plan was changed very early on. Allen would visit the northern states every summer to get away from the heat of South Carolina, which was a common thing for, you know, the wealthier members of society back then. They didn't stay the summer in the South.
Right.
But while he was in New York, he visited Jervis, who was the chief engineer of the Mohawk and Hudson Railway. And Jervis had two new locomotives in 1831. He had another West Point Foundry locomotive called DeWitt Clinton,
mm-hmm.
And he had an imported locomotive, a Stevenson locomotive, called Robert Fulton.
Right.
So these locomotives had a couple of features that Allen was apparently unaware of when he made up the plans for his first eight-wheeled locomotive. And these were, they both had steam domes, which was something he had not seen before. And then the Fulton had a blast pipe.
Yes, because famously, the early version, the Rainhill version of Rocket, didn't have a dome. Things like locomotion didn't have a blast pipe, so they weren't drawing the fire through with every chuff.
Yes, and DeWitt Clinton had a bellows arrangement to provide a blast for the fire.
Mm-hmm.
But Best Friend and West Point, which were operating in South Carolina, neither of them had a blast of any sort, and neither of them had domes. Of course, Best Friend had a vertical boiler, so there wouldn't be a place for a dome anyway.
Right.
But Allen had had a lot of trouble with the West Point locomotive because it has a horizontal boiler and it didn't have a dome and it didn't have a blast pipe. So it was a very poor steamer. At the time, you know, we have a description of, or rather we have a complaint about the West Point that it ran at a snail's pace and that it emitted smoke in a thick black volume. This is a complaint from one of the investors in the railroad company that was asking why they don't just order a locomotive from England. So he had these complaints about West Point. This is obviously on his mind. The evidence is that the dome and the blast pipes were added to his locomotive after he saw these. When he comes back to South Carolina, he also immediately goes to work modifying the West Point.
Right.
And although he doesn't specify what his modifications are, it's not hard to guess that he goes in and adds a dome and a blast pipe to make it more efficient. In any event, he's gone up to New York. He's ordered this new locomotive. It arrives early in 1832, and we do have, you know, some vague contemporary descriptions of it. Let me get the newspaper article here. The South Carolina, a new engine which has been constructed under the immediate direction of and planned by Horatio Allen Esquire, the chief engineer of the company. And if we go further down, an idea suggested itself to Mr. Allen that a great improvement might be made in the construction of locomotives by equally distributing the weight of the engine upon each wheel, and that eight wheels were better adapted than the usual four. The directors of the company, having determined to increase the number of their engines, the present locomotive was ordered from the West Point foundry and is now in successful operation on the road, moving on eight wheels and working on each end with the crank in the center of the road. And it is suspended upon two frames in such manner as to give but one ton weight to each wheel. The experiments made with it by Mr. Allen in the last week and on Monday fully realized his most sanguine expectations. It is of 20 horsepower, and consequently will be more than equal to the conveyance of all cars now on the road. This also brings up another one of the oddities of this locomotive design, which was that it only had one cylinder per truck.
Yes.
So there's one cylinder on either end.
So it's not like how you would imagine, say, like a fairly power bogey where, you know, there's one cylinder on each side and they're opposed.
Yeah.
There's one cylinder per end. Are those cylinders powering all four wheels underneath them?
No, the locomotive basically set up as 2-2-0 plus 0-2-2 wheel arrangement. You've got two four-wheel trucks, and each truck has one carrying axle and one powered axle, with one cylinder on each truck driving the powered axle. And this all seems, you know, it's very bizarre in hindsight, but apparently Allen was trying to make the locomotive not any more complex than it needed to be.
And I guess weight is on his mind all the time. If you've only got one cylinder per end, you know, that's half the weight of the cylinder. So
it wouldn't weigh more than a conventional locomotive because it doesn't have more parts than a conventional locomotive, basically. They're just spread out more.
Yes.
And another feature that's particularly bizarre is the boiler of the locomotive. It's got a central firebox located between the two bogies. And then it's got four very small boiler barrels, which come out, you know, two boiler barrels on each side of the firebox, and then the smoke box on either end. This is very strange.
So it is very strange. Yeah, because for us looking back now, it just seems preposterous. But, I mean, at the time, you were having all sorts coming out. So it might not have seemed so, well, I don't know, flawed to them at the time.
Yes.
It's that idea of having one firebox, two smoke boxes, and four boiler barrels in between. There's just... But I guess it's all to do with that thing about weight distribution, like you were saying.
Yeah, there's although he doesn't expressly detail why he went with this design choice, you can look at the drawings, you can make some conclusions from how things are laid out. First, if he's only using one cylinder down the center line of the locomotive, if he puts two boiler barrels over this rather than one big barrel, then he can put a space in between the barrels to clear the moving parts, the crank and the connecting rod. The other thing is, by doing this, he can have the boiler serve as a frame for the locomotive, since the boiler is self-supporting. The trucks are basically mounted directly to the underside of the boiler, which wouldn't really be possible if he just used one boiler barrel.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is, I don't think it would have seemed as strange to someone in 1832 as it does to us today, because at the time, for high-pressure steamboats, it was very common to have one firebox connected to multiple boiler barrels.
Of course. Yeah.
So I don't know if he got the idea from that, but I think considering that the locomotive was built by the West Point Foundry, which had been building steamboats and boilers for, you know, over a decade by that point, it wouldn't have seemed particularly strange to them. But it does seem very odd, you know, to us when we know what a steam locomotive looks like.
Yes. With the firebox in the center, one of the things that comes up with the Fairley design of, you know, 40-odd years later is that you fire it from the side. Is that the case here?
Unfortunately, we don't actually know how the locomotives were fired.
Right.
It's one of the mysteries of the design that is never actually explained in any detail in any of the descriptions, any of the contemporary descriptions of the locomotives. We do know that the drawings of the locomotive are not complete. The drawings of the locomotive that we know of were made by a civil engineer named Christian Detmold, who was one of the surveyors of the line. And these drawings resurfaced decades later during the Winans patent dispute. At that time, Detmold claimed that the drawings were preliminary drawings that were made in the winter of 1830-1831. Mm-hmm. But we know from contemporary descriptions that this could not be the case. First, we have some of the circumstantial evidence which shows that the engine was designed without a steam dome, but the drawing shows it with a steam dome, so that's already suspect.
Right, yeah, of course.
And then we have an engineer's report where Horatio Allen details changes he wants to make to the design. And in this one, he mentions that the locomotive has side platforms. And the drawing doesn't have any platforms that I can see anywhere on it. But presumably, if it had side platforms, they could bring fuel from the tender to the firebox.
Yes.
But unfortunately, we don't have any particular description of where the platforms were attached other than that they were on the side, or even really what they were intended for, if that was where the driver stood or what was going on with them. But it does show that the drawings that we do have are probably most likely, these are the preliminary drawings for the rebuild of the locomotive, not the locomotive as it originally existed.
How does Fairley's locomotive of, you know, 30-odd years later differ from the Allen concept?
So the interesting difference in concept here is when you look at Fairley's idea, what he wanted to do was he wanted to use all the available weight of the locomotive, you know, to pull the train.
Maximum adhesion.
Yeah. Yeah. Whereas Allen, he's got eight wheels, but only two powered axles. Mm-hmm. And his primary concern is just, you know, to spread the weight out over the rails. Mm-hmm. And indeed, the locomotives were also used with a tender, possibly even two tenders.
Right.
We know from the equipment roster on the South Carolina Railroad, they had about twice as many tenders as they had locomotives.
Oh, interesting.
So it might have been operated with a tender at either end, mm-hmm. but unfortunately we don't have any actual description saying this, other than early on we do have description that they have four locomotives in use and five tenders attached to same.
Okay.
So at least one locomotive has two tenders on it.
Yeah.
So the primary difference there is, you know, Fairley's got, you know, we're going to use all the wheels are drivers, and mm-hmm. we're going to put the weight of the fuel and the water on the locomotive. We're going to get as much power out of the locomotive as possible. Mm-hmm. And Allen's concept is just, well, I want to save the track. We're going to spread the weight out as much as possible. Mm-hmm. We can have a bigger locomotive, but it's going to need more wheels and it's going to need more points of contact. So while they have a sort of superficial resemblance, they are actually quite different in concept. The only point that's really the same is the double-ended feature of the locomotives. Allen did not want to have to turn the locomotives around, and he did not think it would be safe to operate a 420 in reverse.
Okay.
So he wanted a locomotive that was symmetrical, so it could be run forwards or backwards exactly the same way.
We know that the boiler was part of the main structure of the locomotive, but the trucks that it sat on, how were they made?
So we're fortunate that we have a drawing of the trucks used on the South Carolina. However, This one is not a drawing that was produced by Detmold.
Wow, okay.
Like the other drawings we have of the locomotive. This was a drawing that was found in the archives of the West Point Foundry in the 1870s. So basically we have a wooden truck, that the frame is made of wood, and then it's got a central beam that's sat transversely through the center of the truck.
Right.
Upon which is the support for the rollers that would roll on a sort of flange that was fixed to the undersides of the boiler barrels.
Okay, so the boiler is essentially suspended on two wheels that are free to turn.
Yes. So there's a central pin on that central section, the transverse section, mm-hmm. and that's fixed to like a transverse section of metal that connects the two boiler barrels together mm-hmm. in the center, and then the actual weight is taken up by the rollers, which allow the truck to, you know, swivel.
Wow. Okay.
And there's a few other interesting details. We have the springs are all located underneath the truck. The frame itself passes underneath the driving axle, but over the carrying wheels.
How strange.
It's a very odd layout, but it would have allowed them to mount the boiler lower down, nearer to the ground.
Of course, so you get the low center of gravity.
Yeah, how everything was connected is something of a mystery, because if you look at the Detmold drawings, there are some of the details of the valve gear given out, but how exactly to make sense of what he draws is still a little bit of a mystery to me. Mm-hmm. We don't have a description of the actual valve gear. My take on it is that the locomotive had a single slip eccentric for each drive axle, and we see the levers for lifting the drop hook on the side of the firebox, and then we see the levers that would have been connected to the valve rod sitting on top of the firebox. It's a very strange mechanism, and of course, there had to be joints in all the connections so that, you know, the trucks could swivel back and forth.
And lots of lovely points of wear, I'd imagine.
Yes, and it's when you take that into account, you can kind of understand why the valve gear proved to be, you know, the failure point on all of these locomotives.
Of course, yeah. So if we go back to the introduction of the locomotive that's described in the newspaper article, I kind of always take these with a pinch of salt, because it does seem that newspapers of the time would report on technological innovations and stuff, say, and it was a great success, and they just needed to sign off their story. But what happened in practice?
We know from the company reports and from the engineers' reports that apparently the South Carolina, when it was originally delivered, performed exactly as they wanted. It worked fine.
Okay.
But after it had been in operation for a couple months, some problems became apparent. And this is where things actually get really interesting. This is where the real story seems to vary from the recollections that were, you know, written down many decades later. In April, the locomotive has been in operation for a few months now. And Alan writes that he wants to make some improvements to them. And one of the improvements that he considers most important is he wants to secure the cylinders, slides, and other working gear at once to, or rather between, the boilers, by which means an unequal motion of the boiler and cylinders, which now exist, will be avoided. So this is very intriguing, because the description of the locomotive that's generally given is that it had cylinders that were fixed into the smoke box, and that it used a ball joint on the connecting rod, you know, to adapt the motion to the crank, which would obviously be moving back and forth as the engine rounded corners. As originally built, the cylinders moved with the trucks, and Horatio Allen had used a flexible steam joint to bring steam to the cylinders. Problem was that this joint kept breaking.
Well, that's the problem that plagues nearly all articulated locomotive designers, yeah.
So he rebuilds the locomotive. The cylinders are now in a fixed position. They're fixed to the bottom of the boiler. The cylinder's partially in the smoke box to keep it warm. Which, again, is something he would have seen on the Robert Fulton, the Stevenson locomotive, when he visited the Mohawk and Hudson.
Of course, yes.
But the other problem was the crank axles were prone to breaking, and the wheels were prone to breaking. The wheels on the South Carolina, as it was delivered, were partially cast iron and partially wood with a wrought iron tire. And he had a cast iron hub, wooden spokes, and cast iron fellows. And these apparently just did not hold up.
Right.
So he has imported some wheels of the Jones pattern, which is the sort of wheels you see on the novelty. So now the wheels are all iron. And after these improvements, Alan is apparently satisfied, and he asks if he can order some more locomotives. Alan had gone to the board of directors and basically said, you know, this locomotive, everything's working fine now. It works with much more ease on the tracks. It's a valuable improvement that will save us a lot of money in the long run. And he requests permission to order 6 more double-ended locomotives. And the board consent to an order of 4. So he goes north in 1832 in the summer, and he places an order for 4 new locomotives on the double-ended 8-wheel principle. He makes this order with a man called Messiah Bliss. And Bliss is a steamboat operator, more famously in the history of New York. He's a land speculator. He had bought some land that was considered basically worthless, and he put in streets and stuff and parceled out the land and basically set up a subdivision of sorts. But in this story, he goes to Messiah Bliss. He places an order for 4 locomotives. Their construction is going to be overseen by a man named Ezra Kitchell Dodd, who was son of Daniel Dodd, who was one of the people associated with the building of the SS Savannah,
right,
the first steamship to cross the Atlantic. So he has, you know, some connection, some expertise here. But unfortunately, it's now 1832 in New York.
Well, is this only a few months after the first locomotive of this design has been introduced then? So he's going on about 3 months worth of trials when he wants to place this order?
Yes.
Wow. I mean, asking
Yes.
for so many so soon. No wonder they wanted to take it down to four locomotives.
Yeah, he was very much convinced that this was the future for locomotives. And he was so sure of this that he believed that other railroads would be adopting them shortly out of necessity, that it was so good they would have to resort to a locomotive like this. But unfortunately for him, it's New York in 1832, and it's a summer, and there's been an ongoing worldwide epidemic of cholera, and it finally arrives in New York that summer of 1832. Unfortunately, Bliss comes down with symptoms of the disease, and he cancels all work on the locomotives. And Allan writes back and says, you know, hey, unfortunately, cholera is disrupting all the business here, and I fear the locomotives are not going to be built. So the board is like, okay, well, find someone who will build them. Just, you know, get the best terms you can and see what you can get. So he goes back to the West Point foundry and is, you know, asking them, can you build these locomotives for me?
Do you know why he didn't approach them in the first place and why he went to Bliss instead of West Point?
This is something I've tried to find information on, and I can't figure out. Something was happening in 1832 that was, you know, aside from the cholera, that was disrupting the usual business of the West Point foundry.
Right.
Because we have another locomotive, we have the Jervis experiment, which is being constructed in 1832, and that runs way over schedule. And then we have another more conventional locomotive that was going to be built for the Norristown Railroad. And that one is also delivered way behind time. And I did find some evidence. I know that there was a fire at the workshops that destroyed their pattern making shop, but I don't think that's the only issue that was going on at the works at that time.
So that everybody's having a tough time by the sounds of it. I mean, you know, we're no strangers to outbreaks of disease. So in new urban areas such as New York, cholera would have been horrific for trade.
Yeah, you know, anybody that had any sense of self-preservation was not going to be hanging out in the city. West Point Foundry took on the order. They appear, by all outward appearances, to be very reluctant to do so. And they tell Allan that, you know, if we take this on in the summer, you're not going to get your first locomotive until 1833. So it's going to be a while. All the locomotives that he orders end up being delayed. But we have an additional problem is that the political situation between the northern states and South Carolina was particularly tense in this era. There was a lot of consternation over the way the southern states perceived their being treated by the northern states. And we have things like the nullification crisis going on and debates over tariffs that they considered unfair. So when it comes time to deliver the first of this new batch of locomotives, the agent for the company, William Kemble, says, I'm not going to send it unless you give me a guarantee. So it's delayed because he just doesn't want to send it. It's too big of a risk for him to send a locomotive, and then it could get confiscated or lost, or they just might not pay. So they have to figure this out before it's delivered. So it comes in several months behind their agreed upon date.
Yeah.
And then when they try it out, it doesn't work.
Ah.
So this locomotive, the second one was called the Charleston. They put it on the road and it just doesn't steam.
But was this design modified?
The design was different, mostly in that it had the improvements that Allan had added to the South Carolina after it had been in service for a couple months.
Yeah, of course.
It was supposedly smaller than the South Carolina because we have reference to the new locomotives being lighter
Okay.
than the South Carolina. But otherwise, it was supposedly more or less the same. And this is something that's been a bit of a mystery as regards to the four later locomotives. Is exactly in what ways they differed from South Carolina, because we don't have any works drawings of them, and we only have very vague descriptions of how they work. But we do have descriptions of mostly come from later accounts that were written down, or you know, reminiscences that came decades later. So these locomotives had the cylinders fixed in the smoke boxes, and they had a ball joint on the connecting rods to conform to the curvatures. They might have had outside frames instead of inside frames, but we don't know for sure. It is known that they did differ from South Carolina in a number of ways. when Charleston arrives, it doesn't really steam well. The fire doesn't burn well. There's a problem with the draft. Originally, they resort to just burning a different kind of wood. They're going to burn dry pine in the firebox. But Alan notices that the locomotive is not built to the exact specifications that he gave the West Point Foundry.
Okay.
He calls out in particular that the dimensions of the stack and the dimensions of the exhausting steam pipes are incorrect. So basically the blast pipe wasn't built correctly.
So do we think maybe it could have been being throttled by, you know, an incorrectly sized blast pipe? That's why it wouldn't be drawing air through?
It's possible. I believe that Alvin was probably basing his design on the proportions that he witnessed on the Robert Fulton, since it does seem that he changes his philosophy of locomotive design after he witnessed that locomotive. But for whatever reason, the draft doesn't work with the locomotive as it was built. There's some comments that maybe the boiler tubes were made too small, but this is later backtracked when Alan says, you know, actually the only problem is the blast pipe and the stack are not correctly proportioned. He leaves Charleston and goes to New York, and he oversees construction of the next locomotive, which is called the Barnwell. And when the Barnwell arrives, we actually have another newspaper article where they make note that steam was raised to 50 pounds in 27 minutes in consequence of the superiority of her draft, and the smoke was thrown off freely and in a manner to cause much less inconvenience to passengers than heretofore has been experienced.
So from that, well, one other thing that's interesting there is that they were constructing these locomotives sequentially. They weren't being built concurrently. If he was able to take delivery of the first one and then go and oversee the construction of the second one, that means they're building one after the other, more or less, with very little overlap.
Yes.
Wow. Okay. No wonder they were delayed.
So we have the second locomotive is Charleston, and then the third locomotive is the Barnwell, the final of the double-ended types, which is the Adisto. And then the fourth of the order is never actually built. The contract is changed to a design of a conventional inside cylinder four-wheeled locomotive.
And do we think that there might have been some influence of developments from, say, for example, the Liverpool and Manchester around that time was developing the Planet design, which was a conventional four-wheeled locomotive? Do you think that there might have been some influence from
that? The very beginning, there was a lot of question as to why the company wasn't just going to an established English builder to order locomotives. But when they placed the order for the locomotives, before placing the order for the further four, Horatio Allen had consulted with John Stevens of the Camden and Amboy Railroad.
Mm-hmm.
And Stevens famously had imported the John Bull, which is still in existence. And Stevens was of the opinion that he could have locomotives built in the United States, and there was no reason to go to an English builder. And of course, Stevens had actually built most of his locomotives in the United States, but they were all conventional designs that were patterned after, you know, the John Bull, or more or less typical English locomotive of the period. I know that John Bull is not a standard Stevenson product, but the general layout of the locomotive is the same.
Yes.
For various reasons, the double-ended locomotives just aren't reliable in service. We have the late delivery of the locomotives, which is already causing a problem. And then we have that Charleston doesn't have a draft that's good enough to produce steam. And then we have the Barnwell was operated with a faulty pump. It runs low on water and the boiler flues are damaged, so it's out of service.
So the good one's knackered and the bad one's, well, obviously not performing well. So do we know what happened to the South Carolina?
So all of the locomotives have met with unfortunate accidents by this point.
Ah.
In December of 1832, South Carolina actually burst her boiler.
Oh.
So South Carolina's out of commission. The Charleston doesn't produce enough steam to be useful. Barnwell's boiler flues were damaged because it was run low on water. So they have the Adisto is there, and it actually seems to be running reliably. But it's just one out of, you know, the four that they ordered that's actually working well.
Do we know if there was any cannibalization of parts from the broken ones towards the Adisto?
Probably not immediately, but the issues with these locomotives had become such a problem for the company in 1833 because they were very nearly done at this point with laying the entire line out. So they really needed to get in the business, but most of their locomotives didn't work.
Right.
And so we have They put together a committee, the Committee on Cars, to look into the failures of the locomotives. A lot of information we know about them comes from the report of the Committee on Cars. They mostly actually ended up defending the locomotives.
Okay.
So they're saying, well, the problem isn't with the design, it's just that the construction isn't very good. And Horatio Allen has basically the same opinion. It's worth noting that Horatio Allen had nothing to do with the committee. They obviously were basically excluding his opinions from the results. But all of the drivers on the line basically said, you know, the double-ended locomotives, they run really well, they work really easily. If they just were more reliable, they would be, you know, the most useful thing we could have.
Do you think that was limitations of the technology of the time? Like, do you think that Allen had ideas that weren't able to be achieved by the technology of the time?
So the idea for a double-ended locomotive, or even just for an articulated locomotive, is well beyond the technology that would have been available in 1832. It's definitely an instance of someone having a concept in their head that can't really be made into a practical reality with the technology that they have to work with. The main problems with the locomotives were basically, according to them, the materials were substandard, the construction was substandard, and a lot of the parts were just not strong enough. One of the things that gave problems on the three locomotives that came in after South Carolina was the valve gear on all of them was considered too weak, and it was continually breaking. This is another interesting point, was these three locomotives differed from the South Carolina in that they adopted a double D-slide arrangement for the steam valves and the cylinders. This was something that Allen had seen on the Robert Fulton when he visited the Mohawk and Hudson, and it was, you know, for a while, it was the standard design for the Stevenson locomotives. Was instead of using a single D-valve, they actually used two D-valves to do the same job. But it would appear to me that Allen had not considered the increased resistance that doubling the number of valves would have on the valve train. And this is probably why all of the valve gear on these locomotives became deranged in their turn. There was a derangement of parts that was attributed to the valve gear.
What a great phrase. So, but do you think also that lubrication must have been quite rudimentary then as well? You know, cylinder lubrication and moving surfaces and things like that.
Yeah. A lot of times on early locomotives, they didn't even have an oil cup for the slide valve.
Right.
Looking at the Detmold drawings, there does appear to be an oil cup on the front of the cylinder. But again, you know, the lubrication technology was very primitive. You did not have, you know, like automatic steam lubricators or anything like that. You would melt tallow in the cup, and then you would open a valve and let it drip into, you know, the cylinder. Mm-hmm. So they didn't really have, you know, much hope with that particular design if he hadn't designed the actual valve gear itself to be strong enough to deal with that. Despite all this, the committee says, well, even though the locomotives have all these problems, they can all be fixed, and it would be of great value to our company if we could fix them and use them because they ride so easily and they do so little damage to the track. But as it happens, in 1834, they start getting new locomotives. They've got their British locomotive orders from Barry and from Stevenson come in. And then they have Miller had contracted for three locomotives, including one from Baldwin.
Right.
And so they have now a selection of locomotives on four wheels, on six wheels, all different types. And it's decided at this point that, you know, they're throwing good money after bad trying to repair these eight-wheel locomotives. In 1834, they announced that the three of these locomotives are going to be broken up and used for parts. And the only locomotive that's not on that list is the final one, the Adesto, is left off. And we know that the Adesto continued operating for a while on the line, although exactly when it went out of use, we don't know. But we do know that in 1837, the Adesto name was applied to a new locomotive, which suggests that it was probably taken off the line at that time.
Yeah. The handing over of the names tradition railways right from the start, so yes, that makes sense.
Yes, and we know from company reports that in that same year in 1837, the company scrapped almost all of their early locomotives. They don't give names of the locomotives that were scrapped, but we do know that they list that several derelict locomotives are going to be broken up. Okay. So it's more than likely that 1837 was the final year for the double-ended locomotive that still existed then.
So that's 5 years of operation?
Yes, about.
Just about. What claims were made about the performance of the double-ended locomotives? You mentioned that the drivers liked them and the crews liked them. Do we have any reports of how capable they were?
So we do have a few reports on performance of the locomotives. In one of the reports, we have a list of the trains that they would haul. And it says the Adisto would haul freight trains of 12 cars. So if you remember, the cars would hold about 2.5 tons. So you got a rough idea of the performance it was capable of hauling. And then we also have a report on the railroad by civil engineer Alfred Andrew Dexter, where he says that the locomotives were capable of 40 miles per hour. And in one or two instances, a locomotive detached from train had achieved 50 miles per hour.
Which sounds terrifying, frankly.
It does sound kind of ludicrous.
When you have stories of broken wheels and crank axles and all sorts of things.
Yes,
like that.
And you're also on track that's, you know, suspended 6 feet in the air off the ground. Just adding to this. It's also, you know, since we don't really know where the engineer would have stood on the locomotive, but, you know, he didn't have a cab or even a spectacle plate. They were just out in the open. Right. So you imagine it would have probably been a pretty terrifying ride.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. How seriously can we take those claims, do you think?
I think, 50 miles per hour? You know, given that the locomotive did have 5-foot drivers and it had reasonably large cylinders for the time, it was probably capable of that speed, although I don't know if they would have wanted, you know, to go that fast. Horatio Allen was very adamant that trains not run over 12 miles per hour on his line.
Okay.
So.
Okay.
Even if they tested it one or two times at the speed, it would not have been used regularly that fast. Mm-hmm. But we do have testimony from Allen where he states that if he wanted to take notes, he would stand on the locomotive rather than sit in the passenger car because the locomotive rode so much more smoothly than the passenger cars did. So we do have some evidence that it probably would have been able to stay on the tracks. They were apparently, all the drivers on the line did say that they all rode very well and very smoothly and very easily on the tracks. So it probably could have made that speed, you know, once or twice that they mentioned.
And you've referred quite a lot to legal cases that have referenced this story. Well, can you tell us more about them to begin with? And then we'll come on to your discovery of the story.
One of the reasons that these locomotives have any sort of lasting fame historically was that in 1834, Ross Winans, however you want to pronounce it, was granted a patent for an 8-wheel passenger car. Mm-hmm. So he has a passenger car that's set on 2 bogies. For a while, he just sat on this patent. He didn't really do anything about it, but by the 1840s, there were more and more companies that were building 8-wheel cars, and he finally decided he was going to sic his lawyers on them and see if he could make some money off this patent. In the ensuing litigation, which lasted, you know, like 2 decades, they brought out these previous experimental designs, and Allen's 8-wheel locomotives was one of the designs that they brought out to give as an example of prior art. And a lot of the information that has been written down in books comes from the testimony that was given in this case, not from the original documents from the 1830s, which I think is where some of the details got confused. We have Allen describing how the locomotives functioned and what the design concept was. Eventually, it's basically decided that the basic concept of the 8-wheel passenger car was already embodied in the 8-wheel locomotive. And it brings, you know, all this attention, you know, to these locomotives, which prior to this, Allen didn't really want to discuss because it wasn't, you know, it wasn't a big success for him.
Yeah, yeah. Well, after that initial excitement where he said this is going to be the next big thing, and then, you know, all of these problems, you know, less than 5 years later, they're all in the scrap heap.
Yeah. So up until that point, it had kind of just been, you know, something that no one paid attention to. But the legal case brought all this attention back to these locomotives. Mm-hmm. And with the decision finally being made against Winans, Allen finally had some satisfaction that, you know, his locomotive did have a lasting impact because now anybody could build an 8-wheel passenger car and not get sued.
Yeah, it works out in the end. How did you discover this story?
I think the first time that I came across this was I was reading an old book on locomotive design. I don't remember exactly which one. I think it was maybe one of Angus Sinclair's books. Mm-hmm. And I remember I was in the library, I was flipping through the pages, and I come to the Detmold drawing, the plan view. And it was kind of like, someone had just shown me a photograph of an alien. Like, this is really weird. And this shouldn't exist.
Yeah.
Just because it's so perplexing, particularly in the plan view where you can see the four boiler barrels from above.
Yeah.
And I remember particularly being the fact that the boilers aren't actually perfectly parallel. They're angled slightly away from each other. That part really stuck out to me. This being like, this is such an odd design. And also it's so anachronistic because it seems very much like someone, you know, took a Fairlie locomotive and then they were like, well, what would a Fairlie look like if they had built it in the 1830s?
Yeah. It's like a steampunk Fairlie. Exactly. Yeah.
It stuck in my mind, but I didn't really know the story behind it until I started doing research on the West Point Foundry and started looking for the original, you know, records and contemporary accounts of these locomotives. And then I got a much fuller understanding of what was actually going on and the reason for how, you know, odd this design looked.
It is a fascinating thing. Can you give me your opinion? Was Allen a visionary? Because if we take into account the fact that most modern locomotives now today run on powered bogies, do you think that that's his legacy?
It's an interesting question to consider. I mean, there's no doubt that Allen was visionary, had a concept that was, you know, well ahead of its time. How much credit he actually deserves, though, in relation to modern locomotives, probably none.
Poor Allen.
it's just one of these things where he had the concept, and he just didn't have the means of executing it properly in his own time. And when the concept resurfaces, I mean, because it's very sound. If you want to build a long locomotive, if you want to build a very heavy locomotive, you want to put it on a lot of wheels, it still has to go around curves.
Of course.
So it's a solution that's fairly obvious.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think that when people were designing, you know, modern diesel locomotives, they're saying, hey, remember that idea Horatio Allen had in 1831? Why don't we give that a try? But I think what's you know, the interesting thing is the anachronistic quality of the design, because when you look at a lot of the failed locomotive designs from the 1830s, they're mostly failing because they're bad ideas, like they're just not sound engineering. So you have and I guess something else that should be touched on is there's a myth in history that, you know, we have the Rainhill trials and there's the rocket. And then everyone looks at the rocket and that's how locomotives are going to be. But that's not actually the case at all, because you have all sorts of wild ideas for locomotives, you know, for years after the rocket appeared, where people were just trying everything.
Yeah.
But most of these ideas, you know, like vertical cylinders driving the wheels through bell cranks and stuff like that, it just wasn't mechanically sound.
Mm-hmm.
And the concept doesn't actually do anything to improve the practicality of the locomotive.
Mm-hmm.
And in the case of Allen's locomotives, you actually have an idea that's sound. It's a practical idea. It has an actual solution to an issue.
Mm-hmm.
It just wasn't executed well. And that I find really interesting, because you do see this a lot in engineering, where someone has an idea and then either the conditions at the time just aren't correct to make it popular, or the technology at the time to make it workable just doesn't exist until, you know, years or decades later. And this is very much one of those ideas that's a sound idea,
yeah,
but the conditions just weren't right at that moment.
Can you tell us more about your book?
Yeah, I have a book. It's just a short book. It's about 100 pages on the locomotives of the West Point Foundry. And it's a collection mostly of contemporary and firsthand sources. I basically disregarded everything from the latter half of the 19th century onward, except in a few instances where either I could find no other information on a locomotive, or where there was some contemporary evidence to suggest that what was being claimed afterward was actually true. So my basic goal was, you know, I'm only going to look at contemporary sources and firsthand sources and see what I can find and try and, you know, assemble all this information in a way that tells the actual stories behind these locomotives. Because surprisingly, no one had ever really given serious attention to the West Point Foundry's locomotives, despite the fact that they built, you know, nearly a dozen in just a short matter of years. And they had, you know, built the first, you know, full-size American locomotive to go into actual service, the Best Friend.
Yeah.
And then we have, you know, the Jervis experiment, which was the first 420, locomotive, somehow they just seemed overlooked. Like, again, there just wasn't a lot of interest in these very early locomotives because...
Well, they just get eclipsed by what comes afterwards, I guess.
Most of the companies, you know, got absorbed by bigger companies. A lot of the earliest locomotives that we know about, we only know about because they served some sort of marketing purpose to the bigger railroads. You know, like, if we look at John Bull and the Camden and Amboy, John Bull was used for decades, basically as an advertising prop.
Yeah.
They would pull it out, they would take it to exhibitions, and if it weren't for that, it probably would have been scrapped. But they had an old locomotive, and they were going to show it off. And then, you know, there's some other early American locomotives that get basically no attention, basically because there wasn't a big company using them for advertising. Like, for example, they have the Hinckley Lion, which operated in the 1840s through the 1890s on a small lumber railroad.
50-year lifespan from the 1840s. That's amazing.
Yeah, it's probably the most original 1840s locomotive in existence anywhere.
Good grief.
But it's basically unknown because for most of its life in preservation, it was just stored in a shed. So no one saw it. It didn't get any publicity. It didn't serve a publicity purpose for, you know, a big company. So with the same idea with the West Point locomotives, because most of them were owned by, you know, smaller companies, or they, you know, they didn't exist. There just wasn't any interest in them, with the exception of, you know, Best Friend. They built a replica Best Friend in 1928. It's a fairly well-known locomotive because it is the first, but the rest of them are basically obscure.
Until now.
Yeah. I printed the book. It's not available in bookstores. I printed a limited run. You can buy it from me directly. Research is ongoing, so maybe in a few more years there'll be a revised edition.
Fantastic. And where can we find a place to purchase it?
If you just want to email me, you can email me at nostalgiccarlife@gmail.com. And if you live in the U.S., it's about $20, including postage. If you live elsewhere, I can get you a quote. I only do have a limited number of copies at this point. I printed 100 copies of the book. I was not expecting it to sell out as fast as it has. I did not think people...
But that's a nice surprise. That's a nice thing to happen.
Yes, I wasn't expecting people to be as interested in it as it turned out people were.
Mm-hmm.
Especially considering I haven't really marketed it at all. You know, just a few posts on Facebook and then the actual Kickstarter campaign. But I had a whole bunch of people emailing me, where can I get this book? Do you have any left? And yes, I do have a handful of copies left. And if you're interested in, like, the real story, you know, behind these early locomotives and the people that, you know, designed them and what their particular requirements were, it's an interesting read. There's a lot of stuff in here that I was surprised when I came across it because I had never seen it mentioned anywhere else. So, yeah, it's been fun, you know, putting it together.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for joining us on the podcast today and telling us the story of Horatio Allen's locomotives.
Thank you for having me.
Cheers. All the best.
All right. Have a good one.